conference record has joined the conference.
Into Amy's office. I know. How did they expect me to shoot? Hovered over my email. I was impressed with how quick they got it to run. Yeah. Why are they all?
I think they have it loaded somehow.
Nice job. I don't even want to imagine.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
Welcome.
I just say hello to you. Thank you. Welcome.
And I was just reading your
comments.
I used to be a
senior. I do.
We're cranking up.
Quality, right, et cetera. And I actually just sat down trying to figure out how to figure out.
overlap was, so I recorded it back in 21.
And on those,
I think the teeth are pretty pronounced here.
That's very complicated for us.
Maybe the intent. Hi, I'm I don't feel like looking for it.
Thank you. basic.
I just want to have it in the card. But do me a favor. You write your stuff down on your page, and I'll send you the information.
My card. That way you can. Yes, come on. I now give it out for you, please.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, everybody. We want to get started, so could everybody please take your seats? We're already running late. Welcome, everybody. Before we can start our meeting, I wanted to take a minute to thank our hosts, the folks at this wonderful community health center, the Greater Hudson Valley Family Health Center. Some of you may know that I'm the CEO of the Community Healthcare Association of New York State, as well as being co-chair of this work group. And the Community Healthcare Association of New York State is the primary care association for all of New York State. All of the federal qualified health centers in the state of New York are members of this organization. We're the trade association for the FQA state. So that's, you know, one of my other hats, and it's a real pleasure to be meeting today here in this beautiful community health center. And I wanted to introduce my friend and colleague and board member, Linda Mahler, the president and CEO. She would like to welcome you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm very proud to be your host this morning and excited to welcome you here to the Greater Hudson Valley Family Health Center located in Newburgh, New York. I know you have very much work to do. Each of you should know the critical role in community health centers play in here at our health center, we promote one of global's accessible and at the highest standard of quality care for more than 18,000 patients in our region. In most cases, we're the only option for medical care available to these patients. We host you at a facility that's a little over a year and a half old. This has transformed our practice in our health center. You're meeting in a brand new room, which is for health literacy and education. One of the many new initiatives we have undertaken to make sure that healthcare is more accessible and more understandable to our patients. Across the hall, we've just completed this new center for dental health that will double the number of rooms available for dental care for our region. This initiative was almost fully funded by the Affordable Care Act. Proving to anyone who dares to open their minds to the possibility that our nation's effort to reform healthcare is producing tangible results right here, right now. If you've ever seen a health center in action, you are now in one. 300 to 400 patients cross the threshold every day seeking expert medical care. I can tell you that my daughter will be here this afternoon, and she's in her 41st, almost completing her 41st week of pregnancy. Her second child, delivered by our doctors, cared for by our pediatricians. She has choice. She's a civil engineer. She can go wherever she chooses. She comes here because of the caliber of the health care, and we're very proud of her. By coincidence, your meeting today coincides with the presentation of the Clothesline Project. As she came in, thought and is sponsored by the Orange County Safe Homes, our domestic violence prevention agency. The project highlights the impact of domestic violence on individuals and families and the path that many victims take to recovery. It is poignant and it is powerful. I urge you to view the display that surrounds the outside of our building, and I'd like you to remember that violence is one of our greatest health disparities. And one last word, I and my board of directors applaud Governor Cuomo, Commissioner Shaw, the members of the MRT and the work group for the courage, determination, and creativity that you all shown. in New York. Let us know if there's anything that we can do to make your day more pleasurable. We're hoping to give you a tour if that's possible and your time permits. Welcome to Newburgh. Welcome to the Great Hudson Valley Family Health Center. We're proud to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Okay, we're going to get into the meeting. As you all know, the meeting is scheduled to go until 3:30. There's no reason why we need to meet until 3:30 if we can get through the agenda more quickly than that. Almost 5 hours from now, we have the final schedule if we need it. We're going to start by, again, welcoming you and welcoming the public who are attending today. We're going to start by introducing the work group members first who are around the table, and then we have three or four work group members who are on the telephone. We do have two phone lines today. One is for the work group members so that they will be able to participate. There are three or four of them. There's another phone line that's for the public to listen in. That's going to be a listen-only line, and hopefully the technology will work well, and we will do it. Everything will work seamlessly. There might be a couple other people also who are arriving by train or shuttle. So why don't we start by introducing ourselves, starting with Theo.
Hi, I'm Theo Shiro. I'm the director of health advocacy in Lake the Road, New York, and immigrant advocacy nonprofit in the city of Miami.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nisha Agarwal, director of the health justice program in New York,
Williamsburg. Good morning. I'm Glenn Lieben. I'm the CEO of the Mental Health Association in New York State.
Good morning. I'm Jackie Beamer, director of advocacy.
I'm Charles King, the president and CEO of Housing Works, and if anybody sees a pair of reading glasses, I have set mine down somewhere and floundering around blind. So.
I'm Diana Babcock, dual recovery peer specialist for Mental Health Empowerment Project.
Noelia Navasalvas Mendoza, Health Policy Manager with the Coalition for Asian American Children and Families in New York City.
I'm Gus Burkhead with the Health Department and the Office of Public Health, and co-staff lead for the work group.
Karen Westerveld for the Office of Primary Care and the Department of Health and Office of Public Health.
Elizabeth Wayne, I've already introduced myself.
Hello, I'm Catherine Mangiano-Sino. I'm with OASIS, and I am representing Commissioner Gonzalo Sanchez, who was called to a cabinet meeting by the governor. And so I have been in the team, so I'm here to represent. Thank you.
Good morning, hopefully, department.
Hi, good morning. Emilio Carrillo, internist and vice president for community health at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Good morning, Ray Brown, senior vice president at the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation.
Hi, good morning.
Okay.
Who's on the phone?
Yes, Dennis Mitchell, Columbia University College of Dental Medicine and the New York State Academic Dental Centers.
Hi, Joe, from New York Academy of Medicine.
Welcome, Joe and Dennis. Anyone else on the phone from the work group? One more member of the work group who just joined us.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Lang with the Amparo Supervisor, and I'm glad to be here because I totally
missed
the street.
Okay, great. Welcome. The next thing on the agenda is the presentation of the summary of results from the prioritization exercise, and Gus is going to present those to us with a slide presentation.
Yeah, if we could before that, Jonathan, I'd like to give a report back on our meeting with the commissioner over the transgender issue.
The people call it talking to me a lot. Charles, can you report back on a meeting that they had with the governor's office last week? week on the transgender issue. If you remember, we did have a report on that last week. So, Charles?
Sure, thank you. I want to thank the chairs of the work group and Gus and Karen. They did facilitate a meeting that Jonathan and I had with the Commissioner of Health last week to discuss his position. He acknowledged that the quotes in the Post and AP were indeed accurate, represented his position. We asserted our strong feeling that it was disrespectful of this group's process to rule out any proposal before it had been vetted, and that it also further marginalized transgender people by singling out their care. He acknowledged that both of those were the case and apologized, but remained very firm that the proposal to change Medicaid regulations to eliminate discrimination against transgender people as far as hormones and other transition services could not be considered by this work group. His rationale was that it did not meet the threshold of empirical evidence that was now being assigned to all of the proposals that we were being considered, that there was that the Department of Health had too narrow a broadband in implementing the MRT to consider issues such as this one. And I think that was kind of the summary of the meeting with him. And so as you noticed when you scored, it was taken off of the scoring sheet not to be considered by this group.
And so that's kind of where we are. I want to say for myself, it would be a surprise that the proposal would be moved without having the ability to be waived based on solely on its merit. I believe that the Tufts grades were prepared for the responsibility to vet all the proposals and then make their own determination on whether something is involved or not. And I was really shocked by the fact that it wasn't included in the proposal. And I think that casts a shadow over the integrity of the process. If any proposal would be removed because of a predetermined political expedience decision, I think that's very problematic for what we're doing. But one of the things that we said in the meeting was that all of our work is going to be valued for time and energy and resources, but up to our already very busy professional lines. And that the speed, the work that some of us have been doing on the LGBT side, we merely removed. So deeply disappointing and very, very disappointing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your statement. We are going to continue with the agenda now and present it.
We have
right now, with the, we're trying out of respect for Charles and Jonathan to give them an opportunity to make their statement, but now we're going to have to continue the meeting.
Yeah, by no means do we want to derail the process today. I mean, there are a lot of proposals that need to be considered. Everybody's worked very hard, and we don't want to take too much time on this. But at the same time, you know, I hope that this work does address this issue fairly soon, because it's very concerning that the process was completely derailed, in my opinion, and folks were acting outside of the work that we were doing, outside of the system. So I realize that we do have to be bold. We have a very ambitious agenda today, but I certainly hope that we can have the opportunity to consider it again in the very, very near future before we leave today.
So I think I, as chair of the work group, representing the interests of the work group and leadership, I think it's, we need to be clear that we cannot consider the proposal that was removed from the list by the commissioner. That's not within our purview. So, it's just not going to. This is out of our hands. It's the action has been taken and it's beyond our control, and we simply don't have the power. Nor do I think it should be the way we're going to spend our time today. Given the multitude of issues and challenges facing the people that we're really here to talk about, so this issue was taken out of our control along with our list. It's out of. Any other, does anybody have any other comments or?
Frankly, being in a public organization and a governmental organization, I very much understand and appreciate the commissioner's perspective. But that said, you know, we were all asked to provide, you know, our input to what we consider to be, from at the first meeting, issues of health disparities among various populations. And at the very first meeting, there was no discussion about sort of what's outside of our purview. So it is disconcerting to me that there was a proposal that, in fact, the entire group didn't even have a chance to review or discuss, and it was just taken off. So I do appreciate that we have a huge amount of work in front of us, but, you know, as a member of the work group, I just believe that we as a group, not just, you know, for two individuals of the group to be put in a situation to take a stand, but we as a group should at least articulate our concern and our, frankly, dismay at the process, let alone the lack of an opportunity to have an open discourse. The commissioner has absolutely the right to decide, at the end of the game, what the policy is in terms of Medicaid moving forward. But that said, it just doesn't feel right.
Thank you. You articulated it much better than I thought, but I agree with you 100%. I think if there's some way, maybe we have some sort of way of doing this, is some sort of piece at the end of whatever we officially submit, that there's some sort of statement about
right.
our concerns about this, maybe that could be part of the official report.
We understand that these are recommendations. We absolutely do.
But to not be allowed to offer a recommendation, I think, speaks volumes of, to me, how they're looking at this process, and I don't like it.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there are certainly several people around the table that are willing to work on doing some sort of written statement that's associated with the process that we're involved in. So let's just, you know, make sure that let the record show that that's the intent of the work group to submit statements as was reflected by several members. And any other comments before we move on to the rest of the
agenda?
The public is not commenting. Sorry. Okay. Any other comments? Okay.
Thank you.
We're going to move on now to the presentation first. And,
what Bill presented and what are in the slides are a summary of the analysis of the spreadsheets which you all submitted. And first of all, thank you very much on a very short turnaround for working through this process with us to try and do the scoring. And I also particularly want to acknowledge our staff, Paul Clayton and Jerry Johnson. We're talking from the slides for those of you on the phone on slide two. Just a reminder that the final proposals go to the MRT November 1st. We actually have a quicker deadline than that to get them into the process. I believe the MRT meeting itself is November 1st, but we really want to get things to the MRT a week ahead of time so they have a chance to get it done. So our time frame now is we have roughly another week to 10 days after this meeting to complete this process. And what my suggestion today, and certainly open to discussion with the group, is to try and arrive at our top 10. We can certainly submit the scoring. The question for discussion is how we arrive at that top 10. This scoring was really intended to be information for us to try and short-circuit the process of trying to figure out where the group was by providing some data, but this is certainly not the be-all and end-all. And I think on a scoring scale of -1 to 3,
can imagine that there's a lot of things that are closed that just didn't quite make the top 10 in any one of these categories, which they still want to consider. So this is not taking anything off the table at this point. It's really just trying to show the people where there might be some areas of consensus.
Is the top 10 a methodology used by all work groups?
No, I think originally each work group was told they had roughly five proposals put forward. I think we need to expand that a little bit. So I think certainly the MRT is looking for the recommendations of this group. The suggestion is that we pick a top 10, we can rank them within that. We may want to have what the process from here on out is that we will take those top 10 and fully flesh out the cost and other implications. If for some reason one of those should fall off the list, for some reason I think we probably ought to have a few in reserve today that we can just go to without having to pull the group again. So the top 10 and a five standby maybe is what we should be.
Is there room for some merging?
There's definitely, in the discussion today, I think a lot of room for trying to combine ideas, and particularly in the data, one area where we could probably already heard from some feedback from people that it was difficult to award so many points to different but related ideas in the data set. So we certainly could combine ideas in any place where you see an opportunity to combine. I think that would be great. This slide just talked a little bit about the finalizing and reporting to the full MRT and basically the outline of the report from this committee. So the charge, the membership, the meeting dates, any outside parties consulted with, and I know a number of you held focus groups or other meetings of constituents to try and put together this information. A brief summary of the discussion and the listing of the recommendations. So this is the template that the MRT is looking for from us. And the next slide shows formally the outline of the report that we'll put together once we have the priorities from the group. And I would highlight the four bullets from the bottom here. It is the health disparities impact in italics, and that is a new addition to the MRT template for all work groups, and that was a result of recommendations from this work group that were transmitted by the chair, co-chairs, to the chairs of the other work groups. So that is now, the disparities issue is now front and center with all work groups in terms of them needing to consider that aspect of any recommendations that they come forward with. So that is already, I think, tangible evidence of the impact of this work group in the whole process. We'll get into the process now that you all went through.
We modeled this after the process that the MRT itself went through last year or earlier this year in arriving at the original round of MRT proposals. We looked at cost, uncertainty, disparities impact for what was previously labeled as efficiency because we thought that cost and quality, in fact, Kalman made this comment, cost and quality basically add up to efficiency. So since we're the disparities work group, we looked at the disparities impact. Since we had to score in these four areas, like you're probably very familiar with this. I believe we got spreadsheets submitted by 17 of the 15 of the 20 members. I would comment that the co-chairs did not vote. The co-chairs are full MRT members, and so I think the feeling was they were going to have another practice later on, so their votes are not here, but thank you very much. We got about three-quarters of the group to submit the spreadsheets yesterday. And what we've done, is do a very simple analysis, and at the back of your folders is actually in order of proposal, the actual scoring on each element. And we did the mean, the standard deviation, and then classified that in terms of the variation, whether the group was clustered very tightly, that would be low variation, or whether there was a broader range of voting, that would be a higher variation, just to get a sense of how tight the group was. We included some other measures for your information. The median value, which is 50% of the votes were higher, 50% lower than the median value, that included there from the median. the minimum, the maximum value, and then the mode is the most common response, even though it's not a majority. So these are very simple statistics. There's nothing sophisticated about the statistical analysis. It's very simple. And as I say, when we look at the ranking, you know, just off the bottom of the ranking are other proposals that almost rank high, and the change of a score here or there might have resulted in other things being on the list. There's nothing magic about the top 10 lists that we have put together here again.
Do you have this, I know you have the top 10, and I know we can carve through all of this, but did y'all do a sort that went beyond the top 10 so that we could see what fell just below? Okay.
We have the spreadsheet, and if we want to do that, we can do it up on the screen and look at it. We don't have it printed out here, but we can sort any of these columns. So I can't read that slide from here, but the first top 10 list that we put together on these two slides, the 7 and 8, relate to the cost. And I think we acknowledge up front that we did not have cost information on a lot of this. That's something that we're going to need to go back once we have these proposals and talk to the Medicaid data people, particularly to try and arrive at the cost. So the cost element was probably the one where you can see we had fewer of the 15 responding. People basically left it blank in many cases. And that's understandable. The ranking of the top 10 by cost may not be what we want to focus on in sort of arriving at our final top 10 list. But we included here for completeness. And so you can see, and even the scores themselves were quite low. So the mean value of 1, which was, you know, only modest cost impact, was ended up being the mean. So I think probably I'll skip over these, but you can see some of the things here, like fluoridation scored highly here because we actually had cost data on that, and people could give it a score. The harm reduction, I think we must have had some cost data on that as well. So in any event, people can see what shows up on this list, but I think what I'll do is move on to slide number 9 for those of you on the phone that looks at the disparity impact. So these slides 9 and 10 relate to how much of an impact we thought this recommendation would have on addressing health disparities, which is in charge of this group. And you can see the number of responses on each of these was much higher. And so the top ranked one with a mean score of 2.6 was the first proposal on improved data collection to reduce health disparities, and we actually had combined two in this improved data collection on reporting of race, ethnicity. This tends to reflect the discussion we had, I believe, at our second meeting, where we agree that we needed much better data on the GLBT community in Medicaid so that we could track better what services they were utilizing, what their service needs were. So that and housing and disability were two other measures that we agreed we wanted to have on the standard data reports that we're able to look at in the Medicaid part. So that was the top ranked. Second was the Medicaid reimbursement for language assistance service. Actually, they both had the same mean score, so I think they're sort of co-lead. Third, acceptable prescription medication labels. Fourth, diabetes prevention program. Fifth, to streamline and improve access to emergency Medicaid. Sixth, on the next slide, disparities in improving access to care. Number 7, eliminate co-pays for expand access for preventive services. 8 was Medicaid eligibility for contraceptive services for women of childbearing age. And we did actually combine a number of the maternal child health proposals in this, and you may want to do some more of that to be sure we reflect that. But that, number 9, providing funding to support integration analysis of child health data. And number 10, Medicaid coverage for community health workers, for prevention and control. So those those were the top. If we can sort, if people want, and see what fell just below the level. Let me get the interest of sort of getting through the presentation, and then we can come back and discuss it. If you look at the quality measures, again, we have the top 10, Medicaid reimbursement for language assistance came out number one, along with the prescription, accessible prescription label. Number three, disparities in treatment, improving access to care. So actually, of the four top 10 lists, I believe we had 23 distinct different recommendations. So there were duplications. So we actually, the top 10 ended up being a total of 23 different proposals that appeared on different lists. Number four is the data access. Number five, streamline and access to emergency. Actually, the quality and the disparity ends up being quite similar. Number six, funding for child health data. Number seven, comprehensive programs to serve youth in transition with psychiatric disabilities. Number eight was the charity care proposal, and I'll comment that the charity proposal got split into two recommendations, number seven and eight. So we sent out a follow-up instruction to only score number seven, but if people scored both, we took the higher score and evaluated. So this score reflects both proposals. Number nine, reform the CON process to ensure ADA compliance. And number 10 was hepatitis C care and treatment. And then I'll just quickly go through the overall impact. And this is the separate scoring, language assistance, data collection, prescription labels, diabetes prevention, streamline and improve access to emergency Medicaid. So as you can see, there's a lot of duplication on these lists. Medicaid coverage for contraceptive services, disparities in treatment, mandating training on sexual orientation and gender, in specifically OASIS and OMH facilities and programs, providing supports, integration analysis of child health data, and Medicaid coverage for community health. Number 10 on the overall list. So I think we can go back now and sort of open up discussion. If this is helpful data that people want, we can try to see what just fell off the bottom of the list. And I think as we go through, maybe we can start back with the disparities, the top 10. Sort of open to the study of the group how you want to discuss these, but sort of talk through these in order just to get a sense. I think we Karen and I have done a little bit of further research on some of these, and we can share that information with you when we talk about the specific proposals. But that would be my suggestion as to how to sort of have the discussion. Unless there are questions, and the hands are popping up all over. So
okay.
Why don't we start? I'm just going to go around.
Sure. Okay, let's start over here with questions. Glenn?
Sure. First of all, two things come to mind immediately. Again, this, from Hope and everybody else's work, this is phenomenal how the quick turnaround. Very, very impressive. You guys did a great job. And that's greatly appreciated. The other point I was just, thinking about this as I was doing my review, and obviously it's so difficult because it's at some point, you're talking really about scale, and you're basically saying, well, on one hand, we're talking about the reform of financing of the hospital system, and on the other hand, you're talking about some low-hanging fruit, including some of the stuff I put forward around PSAs it's really difficult in terms of scalability, and what I would suggest is that, for the group to think about is that a twofold process. First of all, obviously, we'll have our top 10, and we'll come back at the end of the day with our top 10. But those are sort of the top 10. As I would say, those are some of the overarching top 10. I mean, there are key pieces here that will transition the way health disparities look at in the state is our best case scenario. But the other piece is there's some low hanging fruit here that I think we don't necessarily need sort of that MRT blessing to as a group kind of look at and say,
Well, maybe we could just do sort of go forward with it. So I guess what I'm saying is to sort of get the feedback of the group is that should we have a scalability scale, essentially, and figure out what's our sort of our long-term, what we want to see happen over time in terms of health disparities, and our low-hanging fruit piece as well.
I think that's a very good point. Strategically, the group wants to send forward proposals to the MRT that really require the MRT to action. Those
right.
Budget things, statutory things, heavy lifting
right.
that the MRT was very successful in doing in the first round, would be one approach for how this group the ideas. And some of the other, as you say, low-hanging fruit that are a policy change or simply a focus within the health department could potentially be like a side letter to the department that we could then take up.
Just around the issue of the different categories that we talked about, I know that we had discussed saying, well, we were going to make recommendations in a series of categories. I was wondering, one, if there's an easy way to pull up the data to see what the spread is of aggregate, how many proposals did we do in each of the work group areas, I appreciate the complexity of this task, particularly with such a short time, but we had mentioned in previous meetings, figuring out if there's, it doesn't appear that there's anything that seems to be dominating, but it would be unfortunate if something was left out simply because of the political
right.
weight that it had behind it.
There are some dominant ones over, I just real quick did this, number 1, 17, 18, 50, and 4 were in all 3 of them. I think that's significant because we all scored these individually, but if you go through 117, 18, 15, and 4 were through all 3 of them. So that's what I was just looking to see which ones they were. I know 1 and 4 are definitely data. 17 is language.
So we're going to take some of the overall comments and we'll get back into
the We can certainly store the spreadsheet. I mean, the paper version at least lists them together by
right.
Focus area or topical area. So the first, there were 6 in the data arena. You can count them up and you can get a sense of which was the highest score. So if we want to take a strategy of picking one from each, the Chinese menu approach, we could figure out what the highest scoring one in each one was.
Yeah. That might be important.
Yeah.
Before we get there, I wanna pick up on an earlier idea and propose a cheat. because as Hope and I were discussing before the meeting started, the data ones really fall into 2 proposals, and one doesn't really have anything to do with money. It's just about getting people to ask the right questions, and so I almost feel like that shouldn't count. It's a given. We should put it forward to the MRT as a recommendation of this group to just do, and it makes sense, right? The other data proposal costs money, but it's not even like it's a lot of money. And so if we could somehow combine those 2 into 1 and take them off the table as part of our top 10, we'd have some more room to play.
Can we talk about that or just the process, that particular?
The only response to that, Charles, is us being an early innovator state with the CMSL that we've gotten with
right.
the change that happens or not happens. We have an opportunity to redo the enrollment form. So if it does go through the MRT.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting that it not go through the MRT. And if it has to count as 1 of our 10, let's reduce it to 1,
right.
not even 2. Okay. And
gain more prominence probably if it was a formal recommendation on.
Yeah, no, I want it to be a formal recommendation. I just exactly.
With all due respect, I agree that the data is critical, but I don't think that it comes off our list because it has everything to do with policy and practice.
Yeah.
And to me, when we look through all of these, I appreciate your comments also, Glenn, about what is the scalability. That is across everything, and I think it's a central organizing feature. So I would crush it. Take it off as a cheat and leave it out there. And I don't want to disrupt our going around the circle, but I really felt compelled to say I'm not sure we should be voting on off until we go around
So I'm not saying take it off. I'm saying consolidate it to one.
Combine all.
Yeah. Combine it all into one nice little package.
The first four, the data.
Okay.
Two of them and one of them.
Yeah.
They're all, it'd be all related.
Can I just make one comment on the lumping question, lumping or splitting question?
Yep.
And I think it's too early to make decisions, but I think we have to be really careful not to lump too many things together, because sometimes your recommendation is implementable when it stands alone, but if you have four that are kind of in the same general area, it can die of its own weight. Mm-hmm. So I think when we come back to this, we have to be really careful not to sacrifice implementability and spread by being economical with the fact that we're going to get a bunch of things into 10 priority areas.
Okay. Other early observations before we get into a proposal by proposal? Anybody else? Okay.
I know that my initial question was going to be like, together list of the proposals that were in all categories. I know that we're not really focusing on cost as much, but on the other three. And so thanks for identifying which ones those were. I'm also wondering if as a possible thing to save time to have those more automatically be part of our top 10. It's obviously probably like more conversation that needs to happen on everything else, but that's one possible way that we could start to think about
process. It doesn't mean that makes sense. I mean, those are proposals that showed up across all four. So can we
maybe we could talk about each of those, because I think we might have done some further researching in the department on.
How do you
want to
do
this? Should
we start at the top?
Are those
four?
Well, let's see. If we look at the disparity, I don't know if I'm going to talk to the here, but.
Hey, cool. Oh, my goodness. Now turn your computer sideways and see what it is.
About Medicaid capturing data. You're talking about hospitals and health centers capturing data through the two maps. I mean, what can we be more specific? We could be creating a power table. You know, what are we, when we talk about data, who's driving the train? I think we need to think a little bit about some of those methodological things when we articulate our recommendation. I think that what the central takeaway is that we use the HRET type methodology in terms of gathering that information, and I would imagine that that would be a recommendation to HRA in New York, for example, in capturing Medicaid data, as well as, you know, the hospitals have to collect data and the health centers for SPARCs and internal use. So we need to have whatever recommendations we make this data, we have to be cognizant about the Medicaid environment and the provider environment and how the two of them could speak to each other or not.
So you're really talking about the data back from the data.
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't know how much we need to get into the details of the implementation. I think, you know, there's five different groups that are debating this right now. The IOM came out with a report about how to best collect this kind of data. And I think, you know, our recommendation it should be, in my opinion, that it's really important and it needs to get done.
Right.
It needs to be, you know, there'll be a process, I'm sure, by which this thing
right.
will determine what
right. Right, Neil. I do think that we need to make it clear that it's data collection by whom? By Medicaid? By providers? You know, I, that wasn't clear to me when I. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because Neil, if they say, okay, providers do it this way, and then nothing to the state, if Medicaid goes on doing it their own merrill way, and we're doing all this new data collection, then what do we have? You got to have everybody doing it.
Certainly, at one level, this would be better. I think the discussion was this. Data collected
Medicaid
enrollment.
So this is Medicaid enrollment.
Well,
that's,
I mean, the MRT is Medicaid reform.
Right. Okay.
So focusing on proposals. Now, could those same data standards be used in other data collection arenas? I think that we can certainly say yes. This would be an attempt to standardize what the federal government is going to be adding.
Right. But our basically our area of mandate is Medicaid. And Medicaid would collect data this way. Then, and then we would recommend that then providers also make their data collections coincident, so you don't have a serious data mismatch.
Some of that will happen, I think, with the Affordable Care Act and requirements
right.
there. But this group went beyond the data elements that the Affordable Care Act requires.
Right.
So that could be a part of the recommendation.
Not being an expert in care, can you tell us a little bit about how it went beyond the ACA recommendation?
The EPA, as I recall, did not have GLBT information. Did not have housing information, did not have...
It also didn't dive down into race and ethnicity in every category. Yeah, very, very specifically, Black African-American was just one lump.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the areas that we asked to have it more detailed.
From the provider community is going to be driven, I think, by what the Office of the National Coordinator of HIT is doing, and that will, looks like, will include housing, will include granular ethnicity and
disability.
Yes.
So, I think we're calling out the need for people.
That is, the data is focused at Medicaid enrollment, or that the data that we're collecting is about the Medicaid population. I'm concerned about the lack of comparison with commercial and other insurance, and how do we ensure that there is equal care between the two? So, 3 seconds.
It sounds like the MRT will deal with Medicaid issues. This group could also recommend that whatever solution is found there be more widely applied.
It's only CMS.
To all health data.
What CMS does, so go commercial insurers. I mean, so CMS really has to get on the train with it.
And I guess the health, I don't know a lot about it, but the eventual health exchange that would be established.
Right.
The state will control what data are collected there.
Right.
And those would be commercial plans.
Right. You said you were talking about commercial plans that are involved in Medicaid?
Not necessarily.
Oh, you're just talking about all the
right.
all health plans.
All the health plans. I'm looking at the disparity.
Right. And in terms of Medicaid, you know, for example, in the health home, you know, the metrics are all QAR, you know, HEDIS metrics, which are all, you know, which right now we can't look at by race ethnicity because we have lousy Medicaid data. So in order for quality, you know, the state's quality initiatives to be real, effective, there has to be a real clear method that Medicaid needs to do this, and we should state it for quality, it's for a lot of different reasons.
Okay.
Okay, so we're starting to move down this way.
Right, so I think we've got the data, the end of the group on terms of the data, and we'll look to combine some of those. The second one on page 9 is the Medicaid reimbursement for language assistance service.
This is one where we had a little bit of discussion, and what we think is the case now is that in the hospital rate, this language assistance is currently one of the factors that goes into developing hospital rates, but it may not be a factor in other rates in other sectors.
Language assistance. I don't know that.
Part of what, how rates are determined for
itself.
So in hospitals, how's that?
Yeah, I never heard that.
$28 million for median enhancements for language assistance for the hospital. So we just have to be mindful, we are going to make recommendations for the hospital that we're going to have to make sure it's budget neutral, and they're saying that money will be pulled out of those rate enhancements. Allocate those dollars.
Is that something that came from the MRT right now, or is that? I never heard of that before.
That was more private voluntary hospitals in New York City. And the proposal that was put forward actually also has some only goes towards providers who can document that they actually offer the language services, so I think it's a little bit different from the way that $28 million is allocated. So I think they're not saying you can't make a recommendation. It's just we would just have to take that into consideration, and you may want to make a recommendation around those other hospitals or those other settings that are paying language reimbursement. So you do have a recommendation for pharmacy services, for example. You know, do you perhaps want the state to do something with an ACT language line when a patient goes to a pharmacy, for example? When a patient goes to a DNTC that might not be getting money now, you know, do we want to make a recommendation to get that paid for?
So are you saying that the $20 million is what we have to spend?
No, we just need to be mindful that whatever recommendation we make may mean if you're making a recommendation that gets adopted by the MRT, that money would have to get
recommendation could acknowledge that there is some intent of the group is not to, you know, certainly disrupt something that's already there, but it's a factor in maybe.
I have a question related to that, though. That was in the 2010 budget, right? So hasn't the money run out, or has it been reallocated year after year?
What we understood was that it was sort of an ongoing part of the reimbursement.
My education, $28 million goes to private hospitals.
That's the only thing that's
our city.
I never heard of
that.
How do they quote it? So say that again.
The $28 million is going strictly to private hospitals
in New York City.
For translation. So what about the New York?
That's not a private hospital. Right.
Public hospitals were excluded, and frankly, while I'm not an expert in this, I'm not sure that there was any level of post-2007, any level of continued explicitness, if that's a word, about the expectations of those hospitals that had received the dollars in 2007. And in as much as subsequent to 2007, I'm not being an apologist for the voluntary hospitals,
right.
But their Medicaid rates have been reduced. That, frankly, I don't know that anybody really remembers if they got money for it, whether they know if it's still in there, because the rates were reduced.
Right.
So did you take it out of everything except for the add-on for language? Who knows? So it's a little, frankly, it's a little disingenuous to talk about a mere $28 million. Again, I shouldn't even be talking about this because we didn't get it. But a mere $28 million that was put in 1 year, when I was there, say more than $28 million was taken out of hospital rates in subsequent years. But I think the real issue, if I may say this, is that there should be, I believe the group is recommending that it be very transparent that hospitals, DNTCs, doctor's offices, pharmacies, mental health agencies, that when they provide care for a patient who needs language access services, that in the same way when they order a test or when the patient gets a certain procedure, that they're, you know, the APG or whatever it's called has a recognition of certain components of that visit, and that the language part of that visit should be paid for. And I would dare say that there should be very strong expectations as to the documentation of that language service and in the bill, for the billing.
Yeah, so that they're not, I mean, isn't that part of the problem is that some of these private hospitals are getting money, but they're not, when it comes to Medicaid money, spending hardly anything. They're seeing like maybe, what, 7% of the Medicaid population, whereas the
I think that's a different issue.
But
what about transparency? I think that's the issue.
And I'm wondering, with the language disparities, how I'm thinking that probably ties in. I would imagine that ties into that also.
Here's a question. I don't know whether
they're
having a
sidebar.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, there is. You know, we're trying to get to a decision on this $28 million. So, any comments on that?
Well, in terms of how, you know, if you're looking at it and the money flowing through management, right?
Well, that's what we're talking about. What happens if the service sector sort of goes away?
Exactly. And it's
when
we know it's going away.
So I guess how does this operate? And maybe we don't. Again, the group doesn't need to say how it's done, but somehow. Needs to be explicit in managed care reimbursement and rates.
So part of the problem with fee for service going away is that the cost report basically allows you to put in service, because it would be very simple under fee for service system to say a reimbursable
original proposal didn't have like a fee-for-service reimbursement. It's more
For the SQHC, it's a little easier. Our services, we still have a cost report and you put it in. And so the SQHC build it into your cost.
Managed care were required to.
By having it, and I don't know
an APP code, and managed care were required to.
But if it's not, it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
If it is, and it's already covered.
So
we should check on that.
The question is, how does this operationalize in the new world?
So in the new world, even to exceed this covered, because we get wraparound payments up to our, prospective payment system rate. But that doesn't cover the hospital fees with it. And I think that would still be left over. And if it's not an allowable cost in the cost report, that's not covered in that SQHCs either. I just don't know.
Right. The hospital...
We got people with their hands up over here, so.
So I just, with regard to Murray's comment, I supported the proposal, but I didn't understand why, what the barrier is to actually, whether it's within APGs or wherever, a provider couldn't just, if you need translation services, you bill a code for that translation services as a...
You talking about the hospital?
Anybody, whether it's a...
That way anymore.
Yeah. Right. APGs don't allow that.
APGs don't.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
But why couldn't they? I'm not wrapping my head around...
They're not a line item.
I mean, this
is
essentially a carve out of a particular service, which is not in direction.
Acuity and...
diagnosis and
intensity acuity, not line item service the way it used to be.
Sure, but there are other sort of add-ons, right, to if under the APGs. If you're billing under the APGs, you could add
enhancements.
And so the question would be, could this be structured as an enhancement? So if you had to pay for translation services, you would simply bill for an enhancement to the visit and require managed care to do the same thing, and that would carry whether it's inpatient or outpatient.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I understand it, it's a capitation system where you have a risk adjustment, right, for a particular individual who would be designated as LEP, and you would get reimbursed regardless of whether or not that individual uses those services, right? So the I mean, that's the new model that we're working in. So, and I think my understanding, and you know, I would love to go back to fee for service. From my understanding, it's gone. The days are gone. So the issue is that's the model we're working in. How do we ensure that people don't enroll a whole bunch of LEP patients in order to get the risk adjustment and then provide the services? So, I mean, I would love to find out, as Charles said, you know, if it's possible to do fee-for-service, sure, let's push for it. You know, if in the political reality we're existing in, it's a capitated system, then we need to include, one, you know, sort of that as a provision, and then second, an accountability measure so that it's just not a slush fund for them to recruit as many LEP patients as possible without actually providing services. But, I mean, that's... Am I correct that this is sort of the situation that we need an accountability, a risk adjustment provision, and then second, an accountability mechanism, and I don't know what that looks like.
And I was just going to add that this proposal is actually based on legislation that's been kicking around for many years now, and includes sort of the accountability piece, which allows flexibility for providers to document in whatever way it makes sense for them. Open to sort of audit or examination by the department if that is necessary. So those legislation was drafted well before the new regime kind of managed care takeover, so we may need to look at that again. But there's actual, we need a statutory change. And Charles, I don't know if I misunderstood your question earlier, but we'd have to first opt into the sort of federal option to be able to do language services in New York before any of the sort of change. It doesn't exist already in New York.
Yeah. No. I get that. We would have to opt into doing that. But when people say fee for service is going away, I mean, as a DTNC, I bill a managed care company on a fee for service basis. We're still operating in an APG world, and I understand that that has changed, but if that's where an enhancement, I'm just able to wrap my brain around this much more simply in this way, and maybe I'm being too simplistic about it. But.
Well, we might be getting, I think we need to be strong on the implementation.
Yep.
And then other folks who understand how this could be implemented need to...
That's fine. I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. I think we've got the sense of on that one. The third one on page 9 relates to the accessible prescription medication label. And I'll just comment that I had a conversation with the Board of Pharmacy in state education. This is, again, maybe an example of a proposal that's been kicking around, so to speak, for a while. They felt that there would be a significant price tag associated with this in terms of all the software companies that do prescriptions to make changes. And, you know, there's only so much that can fit on a prescription label, et cetera. So they apparently have looked at this issue before and felt that it would put this forward, it may end up having a very large price tag associated with it. Just wanted to just bring that to people's attention.
So they said a price tag would be on the state, or it would be on the...
Well, there would be a cost to the industry, if you will, to basically change. And I guess many of these pharmacies serve multiple states, so it would be basically potentially
One suggestion with the language access is, would we want to add to our recommendation for pharmacies where the state has some kind of 1-800 number or something of that sort where we have an AT&T translation line for patients to be able to access at the point of sale or something?
But then the point that was made, you know, if we put back together a recommendation that there may be one piece of it that may be controversial, and I don't know whether this particular pharmacy one would be controversial, would that then take away from the overall, the other piece? That's my concern.
So I think this is an area where an implementation time of a year or a year and a half or something would benefit, because all of these systems are upgraded regularly. And so instead, you know, by January 1st, everybody needed to do it. There'd be an enormous cost, and everybody would have to get their vendors to do this. But if New York State calls out a regulation, you know, and I work on a lot of federal IT advisory folks, the vendors all want to be able to do business in New York State. And the only way to do business in New York State is to meet the state's requirements. So they just build it into their upgrades, and they've done that around building stuff. They've done it around other coding issues. So I think we shouldn't drop shouldn't drop the idea, but I think we could say, you know, by January 1st of 2013 or something, and every vendor will have generated multiple upgrades between now and then, and they're going to know them. And do business in New York State requires them to provide software that's consistent with New York State requirements, and lots of other states have requirements of various sorts, so they're used to doing this.
I'll just add that 8 out of the 8 major national chain pharmacies operating in New York currently already do this, pursuant to either a settlement agreement or because they're just doing it because it's good business. So I
what's the this you're talking about?
The prescription access.
Label.
Well, in a
standardization. No, not the standardization.
Well, that's what we're saying. I thought that that's what we were.
I see. So the cost they were identifying was related to the standard.
Cost related to the changing to
format.
Everybody to change that.
Yeah, but the language thing, I think, is ready.
I think the piece that I'd also like to build on is two parts. One is that maybe there's an opportunity to connect it to e-prescribing and meaningful use, because not that I'm asking to change the federal guidelines, but that there might be an opportunity to build on that. And the other piece that I think I may have put in a previous meeting is an overall concern about the EHR vendors and the need for a state watchdog or some oversight body. We're talking about data collection, we're talking about language access. I just know from personal experience that vendors are charging individual organizations to build HL7 links when they've already done it with other organizations. And I'm concerned, you know, ultimately that cost is absorbed by the not-for-profit. I really think that we just continue to want to reinforce the need for some oversight by the state and advocacy that our Medicaid dollars are not being doubled spent on things that vendors have already developed. And that might be this might be one.
And also,
let's try to stay focused. We're gonna, we just need to. So if you can build on, and if we're getting into the details again of implementation, which I think we really need to be able to go back and delegate to, as we write up the proposal for the MRT, to be able to have a sophisticated way of handing off the details of implementation. We are in a position to understand where should we, how that's going to work.
Well, I'm thinking also, we at some point talking about the actual, like the e-prescriptions and the doctor's pads of doing certain things, and something like that could be, you know, preferred language. Could actually be on the prescription pad as a preferred language. That would, I think, would be something to consider down the road. Somebody wants to.
Are there comments?
Sure.
Actually, to pick up on that, you know, maybe to be able to transfer preferred language is captured from meaningful use, part of the demographics, but I don't think it's transmitted as part of the prescribing form. So that would be a very concrete way of sort of making that connection to find out if that's
part of the
prescribing form.
Okay.
Charles and then Theo. So it's feels like we're building a tentative list here, and
yeah, I mean we are. So I think once we get through, we need to look if we can get through all of the ones that were ranked, and then look at what.
Sure, I'd rather us invest in the process of building the tentative list than spending too much time in each one. And so it sounds like Neil offered a friendly amendment to the proposal that would allow us to put this in the tentative list parking box and move on.
Okay.
That's why just very quickly on the prescription piece. I mean, I think we're going to have conversations, especially on cost, right? As you know, we're figuring all of this out even after today's meeting. It feels like, you know, even at the federal level, there is a lot of movement around this standardization piece, and a lot of research has been done on the benefits, both kind of on the quality. quality care improvements, but also on cost savings to pharmacies themselves. And that should be part of the equation, I think. And also, the states, looking at other states like California that have done this, and I agree with Neil that there are a lot of, especially in California, developing systems in New York where it is part of kind of an easier software package that is kind of routine anyway, and that software, prescription software companies already do. So it's just a consideration as later on when we're talking about the cost concerning the SDGs.
Any other comments?
Yeah.
Got that. Okay.
Diabetes prevention programs, this was a proposal to have additional services available for diet, exercise, and other aspects to prevent, increase diabetes and progressive diabetes and provide services. So I probably don't need to discuss that in too much detail.
AJ,
yes.
I don't know who put it out there, but could that person describe for us a little bit about what their vision is of this?
I think that this one may have come from the Health Department's diabetes program. There are evidence-based approaches that actually demonstrate cost savings. Particularly was focused on pre-diabetes, so people who are some may suffer from obesity and blood sugars that are starting to get into the diabetic range. And if you can intervene with a program that includes diet, exercise, lifestyle change, advice on meals, cooking, et cetera, there's actually an evidence-based approach that can help people lose weight, get their sugar under control, and document saving money. So, but you need to sort of scale that up to be more broadly available population-wide. I think that's the specific proposal.
And the authors of this were American Diabetes Association, Center for Independent Living in New York, and Housing.
But it's nothing, Karen. Again, I think when I looked at this proposal, I said, of course that's important, but we're going into a managed care world. And so to whom is this directed? Because if I'm a smart health plan, I'm going to do this. If I got 450,000 enrollees and 50,000 of them are in this pre-diabetes state, I'm going to make sure that they get this done so that I'm going to save in the long term. So I was just trying to figure, I read the Diabetes Association's, their paper that, but it was like, duh. So I guess my point is,
the issue is the
need to be more explicit, though, as to the accountability as to this. And there were a couple of other things that, again, if we're going into the world of a managed care environment where the financial incentives hopefully will be different than they have been in fee-for-service, it may be some others that we can put into this bucket so we don't lose the 10. Related to preventing other chronic disorders.
You're absolutely right, and we need to think of the new environment again. How do you do this? These are services often that are
what
not
you do.
Provided in the clinical setting, may not be provided in the clinical setting.
They may not need to be provided in the clinical setting.
But the health home.
Health home, but others do them in other ways.
We never got any managed care.
So, if I may, and I had a lot of conversation with the Diabetes Association before I submitted this with Susan. I think the real issue is, and I've also learned far more than I ever thought I would over the last several years about managed care. The reality is, unfortunately, that some of these things that you would think in a large managed care plan would be in their self-interest, at the end of the day, aren't, based on how they calculate how they're going to get their reimbursement from the state. So if you're not putting it in there and saying that they have to reimburse for these types of services, they're just not going to get reimbursed. And I think prediabetes is a perfect example of something that costs so little but gains so much that it's, you're right, it's absolutely absurd that we don't reimburse for it, but no plan does, or no Medicaid plan does.
So just to, I mean, is this a recommendation for this work?
I mean, this is more of a statement about the broken health system.
It's about disparities. I mean, I wasn't suggesting I wasn't even suggesting that we not put it forward, but I was articulating with the need to be more explicit as to where the responsibility lay.
And I think I would support being more explicit about it, and I would also support if there is a way taking into account all of the caveats, if there are other preventive measures that we could expand this to include, I would absolutely support that. But I do know that, you know, we see this in the HIV population where increasingly it's diabetes and hypertension.
Mental health
problems.
It goes across the board. Diabetes goes across the
board. Pre-diabetes.
Mental health, pre-diabetes, mental health medication, any kind of, you know, HIV, Hep C, pregnancy, diabetes goes right across the board with all of that.
Well, my comment about appropriateness, I mean, it certainly has to do with disparity, but it is a huge flaw in the way that we address
payment.
And payment reform. For example, now with the APG system, we used to provide an enhanced payment for diabetes educators, of which there are precious few, so it's essentially impossible to implement. So, I mean, I think, you know, one of our jobs would be to up the ante on a recommendation that requires something that can be implemented and measured, and that there would be consequences to the system. Imagine an OMIG that could come in and do an audit on you if you weren't doing adequate prevention.
I have a suggestion that maybe what we would do with at the lunch break is phone back and see with Ken and Jason or somebody like at that level and just talk through how it would be best to frame this kind of idea for the MRT.
One other thing is that the public health part of the state health department has funded community-based diabetes intervention programs. And so while we're talking mostly about provider-based issues, I think a lot of this is really about how do you get money from Medicaid into the community for community-based organizations to be able to sponsor these kinds of programs as well, because people don't become medicalized until they get brain diabetes.
But more grant funded.
Yeah, I think there were 12 statewide diabetes prevention programs funded by the state.
And the New York State Health Foundation.
Yeah, and it doesn't address the whole population wide.
Right.
So I think that's what we're also talking about.
It's not just the clinical.
Also, if a center gets ADA or AADE certification, certain requirements and standards, then they're eligible for enhanced reimbursement. And that's something that, it's a good thing that maybe should be. I don't know how limited that is or how that's incentivized or promoted, but certainly those kind of programs, like the certified diabetes educator, are things that need to be promoted.
Okay, other comments?
Yeah, I mean, cultural competence around it, too. I mean, this is, diabetes prevention is really something that's a lifestyle issue, and there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution to how to do this. It really has to be done. So in some ways, this is a stronger case for there to be a community-based solution to it rather than a provider, sort of saying, you should go to the gym or, eat differently, which is going to have a lot less impact than having a community program that speaks in languages and in sort of vocabulary that is intelligible too.
Okay, any other comments on this one before we move on?
It may be inappropriate because it's not really about health, but I'm trying to tie the main criteria for the health fund on the top five as we narrow in on diabetes, which is worthy.
but there are other critical components. With all the effort going towards health policy,
yes. Exactly. That you brought that up.
I can take the same case. Pre-hypertension, pre-obesity, pre-asthma, right?
Yes. Yes. Because again, they all go across the board. All of them. These five ways.
The risk factors are the same for all of the major, diabetes, heart disease, pulmonary disease, and obesity, as well as cancer. It's a diet, exercise, tobacco, and alcohol.
Yeah, I was going to say.
One of the conversations about the health home, if you want to take it more broadly, it's really that, the public health should be included, and public health partnerships with providers should be included in the health home as well, have joint, with partnerships with a lot of the community-based work, which will be quite different depending on which community you're trying to create the conditions where people can make healthy choices, more easily. But as you say, the YMCA has, Ken Thorpe has gotten approval of the YMCA Diabetes Prevention Program, which is a community-based, as well as a local program in the Medicaid waiver for West Virginia. And there's effort to do that. So I think there's some merit in focusing on SMA diabetes specifically as an example, because it's been the most aggressive program.
I guess, given that comment and Pam's comment, it seems to me that, because this is sort of that tough, this difficult decisions we had to make, as we're rating them, is asthma any less significant than diabetes? So is there a way, given that it seems to be that the healthcare response to, whether it be diabetes, high blood pressure, pulmonary disease, is there a way to sort of broaden it, just not specifically to diabetes? And
the way that Dr. Bruton articulated with the health care waste.
But yeah, not just specifically to diabetes.
Yeah.
The other one.
Right, the risk factors.
Those are
the
consistent risk factors.
Right.
Same risk
factors.
Right, those are consistent
risk factors.
So why don't we, we'll try to do a little contacting over the lunch and then come back to the group to get some further.
My lunch is going to be busy.
Streamline and improve access to emergency Medicaid. That showed up on three different lists. We haven't been keeping track of the multiples, but the prescription labels showed up on three lists. Anyway, streamline and improve access to emergency Medicaid.
So here is population disease specific commentary recommendations for immigrant populations. And proposed description, healthcare providers are eligible to receive reimbursement for treatment and services provided to undocumented immigrants suffering from emergency medical conditions for the emergency medical program. I think that covers it as far as the proposal is.
Yeah, I mean, we can just highlight the three key points of the proposal. One, clarifying the actual application procedures for both providers and for patients. Also, requiring or instituting pre-qualification so that folks can get those Medicaid cards and you don't have to go through the process of applying when you're actually in the midst of also having an emergency. And then finally, implementing a 12-month certification for certain conditions that extend beyond. Emergency, but you can still be able to get the
I don't quite understand the what ongoing conditions qualify for emergency Medicaid, and I understood that there was actually a bit of a tug of war between what the feds think qualifies and what the state thinks qualifies, and I just wonder what the how this plays out in relation to that. So, for example, whether if somebody needs ongoing dialysis, somebody had said given me that as an example. It might have even been you, Lorraine. So I don't know who can answer that, but I.
The proposal doesn't specify the conditions. That's what they're sent to. When advocates are present in the past, we actually held back from specifying particular conditions in case we left something out. So that's kind of a cancer and renal
failure
to handle the situation.
Cancer.
And it would be covered by emergency.
Or even car accident, paralysis. You know, if they were, I mean,
actually, I don't. I don't want to get us into a sidetrack, but I just wondered how exactly what we're advancing here, because I just don't know enough about.
If you're losing this quickly, you don't have conditions specified in here. Justin, I would have to research, federal requirements versus state requirements, and you're saying the state has taken a position already?
There was somewhat of a decision sort of rollback. At one point, there was discussion that emergency Medicaid would not cover certain conditions, as because it was being interpreted, that position was based on a very strict interpretation of what the Fed said. So that, for example, people who needed ongoing treatment for cancer, that emergency Medicaid would not cover that. But then the state basically decided, yes, it should be ongoing treatment. And in dialysis, those were the two most notable ones, Karen and Gus. So I think that the issue, frankly, I think the point of presenting this is that if there is a determination, if someone goes in into an emergency room and then they are diagnosed with a condition that, while there can be immediate quote unquote resolution of the symptoms, but it is discerned from a clinician's perspective that there is medical necessity so that there is not further harm to that individual or their condition, their ability to not have a permanent disability, that they should get ongoing care, and in notwithstanding their a documented status, that care should be provided, paid for through emergency Medicaid. So I think that was the reason it was kept really broad, because I think the rule of decision should be, from a clinician's perspective, whether it's going, the continued care will prevent death or prevent long-term disability. I think those were the major issues.
And so here you're recommending a 12-month certification period with 90-day research.
Research, right. So you still need the clinician to say that if this protocol, this treatment, this medication or whatever was stopped, it would result in a long-term disability, hospitalization, and, you know, death.
And other states have implemented it, so in terms of
right.
Okay.
And the intent is not to put the state at risk for any kind of CMS or God forbid.
The next one is 10 SR.
So this is for some health,
Oh, yeah.
Care for uninsured
Secretary's
issue that we discussed was that, you know, we have the patient-centered medical home and we have the health home, and I think the issue that we addressed more specifically was the issue of the specialty clinics, the specialty programs, and the ability for physicians in the outside of the hospital to refer patients to specialty clinics like at 5:20 p.m. And I think that the idea of a patient-centered medical home support type program for specialty clinics is something that would be a good idea. The same kind of principles go into the patient-centered medical home. Again, you know, despite what might be said, hospitals are really on a very thin line, you know, across the board. And a patient-centered medical home program is very advantageous and it's very commendable because it provides reimbursement enhancements tiered to the level of quality. So I think that to impose unfunded mandates on an industry that's on the ropes is really not a good idea. Rather, programs that create incentives like the medical home would be something that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I would just respectfully disagree. I think we're already paying for care and the care care that doesn't meet even the most basic quality at this point. And the incentive program is what the states come back with year after year as a reason why they would not implement requirements on the on these programs to provide reasonable quality in relationship to the things that I mentioned. And so to create an incentive program, it's voluntary. People have not participated, not even many of the outpatient primary care centers are in voluntary hospitals, meet medical homes, not even primary care programs. So that program has been out there now for years, and they're still not meeting medical home standards even in the primary care area. So to think that they're going to do this in the urology clinic, I think it's just not realistic. So I think we need to mandate the requirement.
Just in moving along, could you just be clear on what is academic, limited to academic medical centers?
It's the training program that basically operates. No continuity, no after-hours call, no communication back to community primary care providers.
So that's
just
hard.
But why limited to
standards?
Why limited to academic medical centers?
So they're the only ones that run these kinds of clinical programs. The clinic are really not. We should really say teaching hospitals. It shouldn't really say. I think that's a different definition than academic medical centers. It's really teaching hospitals, not academic medical centers.
Okay, teaching so I suggest we keep going and then we can come back where this one's called down in terms of the groups.
I mean, this is the one that got 13 responses on overall.
Yeah, no, it was mentioned on, I think, four different, maybe on all four of the so I guess so the question is this one that the group wants to make one of the top 10? So we're plowing ahead. So there are two more that got multiple hits on more than one of the scoring lists. One was 51 MCH, which was medical eligibility coverage for medical and contraceptive services of women of childbearing age. So this was a combination of several of the MCH proposals that expand coverage for women for contraceptive services after they deliver, expands coverage for prenatal care and preconceptional care. So a series of proposals around improving maternal health.
When did you combine them?
They were combined from the last time we met into the scoring.
Okay.
So we already had done the lumping. If you we can 51 MCH.
Eligible women as well as covered by other third party payers. What's that? I guess my question would be is that even in our scope?
Probably not. Yeah.
Yeah.
We could amend that. other one that got more than one hit was ESP, which was the Medicaid coverage for community health workers for chronic disease prevention.
I think that many of us have the experience that community health workers are invaluable in providing medical care to communities that, you know, are from other culture and language. And there's mounting evidence around the country that these individuals do improve health. I know that the New York State Health Foundation has done a lot of work, and they've been working with the state. And I'd like for us to be able, just as we're doing in other things that we have responsibility for, like in payment reform, et cetera, that we make a clear statement that these are valuable positions that should be supported in the payment structure somehow.
I mean, it's up to the group to decide, do you want to do a letter from this group to the workforce group about this, or do you want this to be one of your top 10?
This might fall into the discussion we had previously about diabetes in the community, because I think we're getting away from fee-for-service, which is what the current model to pay community health care workers would be, but they might fall under some more general mandate or strategy for managed care plans to provide community services.
But global, what goes into the global? I mean, you know, that the global could totally exclude community health workers. So I think that there has to be some teeth.
Some standing. There's no standing right now. I think different people use it in different ways, and I think some of the...
But could there be standing? Is that something that the state should... I mean, there's plenty of grant makers out there that are willing to put money in developing standing and developing programs. Should the state...
That's going to be an active agenda item of the work groups. And the New York Health Foundation, for example, is sending over their... proposal. CUNY is also making recommendations. 1199 is making recommendations. So it's coming from three different sources to address them. Several hands up over here.
Sure. A question and a comment. Senator, the very last sentence, $12 for a 30-minute visit. I just want clarification. So is that per provider visit, or is that for a health education session that the community has for this
proposal?
And then if we're going to get other stakeholders that are involved, there's also the Community Healthcare Worker Network of New York, and I know they've been doing a lot of work also nationally to look at standards for community health workers.
There is a lot of focus on what the workforce group is going to be on in that issue.
So I would just like to offer the recommendation that we send a letter from us to the other group rather than using up one of our 10 on this. They're going to be dealing with it, right?
Yes, you stole my thumb. That's exactly what I was going to say. Saying the 10 are so precious, but this is already sort of a major piece for the other group. Why don't we sort of, focus on some of the other ones? We'll put a letter strongly supporting it. But,
I'll point to a couple of our recommendations that are precisely directed at saying outcome presence.
Exactly.
Okay. There was one other proposal that scored on multiple lists, and that was the funding support integration analysis of child health data, and I think we can fold that into the discussion. So we've now talked about all proposals that scored in the top 10 on more than one list. So we can go through the other proposals. all of them, I think, appeared on the disparities impact list. There's only one on there.
Yeah. What number are we up to right now? Just to,
We've got 7. If we help workers.
And that includes the data. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, I know.
I think we've got all but 10 SR on the experience
list. It would be nice if the whole group
could
see what the
7 are. Yeah. Can we have a, it would be nice if it's still a little bit.
Can you have a, that's what it is.
Try it again.
Yeah, because it's track.
Yeah, I wanted to suggest a process that might get us to the controversy quicker rather than slower. Gus had earlier made a suggestion that we pull off some of the ones that we could send a letter to the department or other. And I wonder if maybe we went through and saw which ones those were and endorsed that or not endorsed that, that would leave what's left the ones that people feel require an MRT action to move forward and use our remaining three to fight about those as opposed to something that's just a departmental change.
What's the criteria for deciding what could be done in the letter? What's the set of criteria for determining which proposal would be admissible with only a letter to the department's office versus a full formal MRT proposal?
I think what I said is you might want to reserve the MRT for sort of the quote heavy lifting thing that requires statutory change or major budget initiative, part of a waiver.
Short-term dollars, short-term money, short-term savings. There's no big picture thinking about prevention and about transforming the health of America and all of this stuff. So,
you know, kind of that process.
Public sector just excluded.
Thank you.
But anyway, I just, it's like, you know, I feel like they cut up, you know, in a
sense.
So how do we get that stuff right here?
Can we have a sort of almost like a
preamble
of what Neil just said? Because I think there are a lot of people shaking their heads yes, and it is a really big fear. You know, sort of we're sort of saying, oh, we'll get taken care of. Well, we want to make sure it does get taken care of in the short and the long term.
It's got to be a process of oversight of the plan that they, and this must be considered or paid for or whatever, because we think these are important public health, you know, priorities, and that it's, if, even if they don't make sense at the end of the day to their bottom line, we still think they're important.
Because these are public dollars.
That's where all the dollars are flowing now. So if we need control over all of that stuff, we're going to be a happy place.
So it just, for me, it boils down to recovery.
Can I just raise another, and this has been a real theme of the conversation at the State Public Health and Planning Council, John Rogers Community, and the Public Health Committee that I chair, the John Traditional Planning Committee, about things like the ON process, the community benefit, I mean, and Institute of Medicine Committee is looking at this interface between primary care and public health, and I think it would be really very, very wise for us to do something, whether it's preamble or whatever, raising this issue, because obviously, you know, community-based prevention is fundamental to people that have been disenfranchised because their communities don't offer the options that other communities do. So I'd be happy to work on that with anybody sort of being up to my eyeballs and a lot of that thinking. Ray and Neil and others have done the same, but.
Well, if I could just make an observation that that we're likely to see that connection with Joe and John and others work on the PIPIC, whatever, you know, the Public Health Planning Council, be a place where the next sort of phase of our work could live. So we need to, I think, need to be realistic about what we're doing between now and November when we're making our recommendations, which is really not, I mean, it's a couple of weeks from now, versus what our long-term, the opportunity for maintaining a long-term.
I think a message for this group to that, why not?
This has been the biggest concern for the people that I've talked with is, you know, boiling this down to dollars, which is basically what the state wants to do. But where are the people then? Nobody knows what's going on. There's a lot of confusion. We're talking about grassroots information, getting it out there, and how can, you know, some of the nonprofit peer-run organizations start getting the word out there. And I know I'm sitting here on this work group, but my bottom line is I'm talking to the person on the street, and they don't know anything about what's going on or how it's going to impact them. That's my concern. So, yeah, we're crunching the numbers, but there's a lot of changes going on right now, a lot of confusion. And when it comes to disparities, and that's what this work group is, I think we need to keep that in mind. Yeah, we're trying to make the state happy by cutting money and cutting dollars, but at the same time, how this is really impacting people, and I don't. We shouldn't forget that.
Well, I'm not talking about cutting. It's just about the way.
I think the factor that we're not. The hook, I think, into this is the quality end and the quality of care end. And that's equal part of this whole revolution in how we pay for things is the focus on quality. My sense is this group needs to say, here are the things you need to pay attention to, quality of care that relate. I don't know what the mechanism is to make it happen, but because the clear incentive of here's some money, do it is not but I think we need to focus on what's going to have the biggest health impact, and the hook is looking at quality of care, which is providing and hold people accountable.
Right. I mean, just really quickly, I just think that, you know, we've been seeing very generalities around the accountability thing, and I think we need to talk a little bit more. I know we're in a short time frame about what kind of teeth it's going to look like if we do recommend one of these things, because saying, you know, here's a bunch more money and it should be accountable, you know, I mean, I think, I know that there are mechanisms in place for accountability. I just don't think that if we don't put it in writing, I'm concerned that it will be another slush fund, you know, that needs to be one of the kind of guiding principles that we are, you know, that weave through all these, which is we don't want to give more money for unaccountable care.
Right.
And that for every dollar that you receive to treat needed populations, you need to have proof that you're providing those services. And so I don't feel comfortable, I guess, with just the real generality that there needs to be proof is enough, you know. Where's the stick? A little bit is my concern.
Mm-hmm.
Not the carrot.
I agree with that. I didn't say from the mental health perspective what's happening is that we have a two-year transition. We have the behavioral health organizations coming in for the next 2 years as we transition to managed care. And frankly, I think our community, and Diana, I agree, I think our community is scared to death because we have no expectations. I mean, a lot of these health plans, those are good health plans out there that have done work with people with psychiatric disability. Have they really done a lot of work with people with serious psychiatric disability? No, for the most part, no.
Right.
So we frankly are very, very concerned. This goes to Jackie's piece about some level of oversight, because we really, and what we're trying to do as advocates is try to really push contract language. We have a 2-year window to try to push strong contract language in here, right? You know, at some point, the contract language is by itself is an important piece, but we've got to do something much stronger. And I think that the way the direction sort of the conversation is heading is we've got to, at some point, I know it's not one of our recommendations, but we've got to talk about some sort of oversight piece.
Mm-hmm.
We really do. And not just in generalities, but a real strong oversight piece that involves a real, you know, some group or a bar group or something, where we can sort of really articulate a vision of what our expectations are around oversight and expectations around what we expect from the managed care plan.
Mm-hmm.
Just a paper tiger.
Yeah, I think I might be saying the same thing that Jack and Glenn are saying. What I've been working back and forth with is how are we contributing to systemic transformation through some granular recommendations. I'll just keep going back. I like the idea that you guys are saying, and I like the idea of some oversight where the managed care plans have a mandate that they're focused on disparity, that they're using the data to transform their systems, that they're being innovative, that they're not going to the least common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of our ideas hit that, but I don't think that there's a preamble.
Okay, where are we now?
Zero to seven that we talked about that had multiple hits on more than one four scoring areas. The combined data, language assistance, prescription labels, diabetes prevention, although we're going to get more information in trying to turn that into a more general chronic disease, community-based approach, the emergency Medicaid issue, the disparities in academic medical or teaching hospital settings, and the comprehensive child health contraceptive coverage. So those are the ones that appeared on more than one of the four lists.
I just want to make sure number one isn't it's written. It looks like it's just combining one and four, and I thought we were talking about combining all of them.
Right. These were actually both one and four independently were on more than one list, but yes, we will try to incorporate. We can take the data,
the whole data package,
off the table, and we will try to figure out
okay.
how to put it in there without making it too.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, so.
Charles had proposed that we try to identify those that could be transmitted to the department in a letter. We can do that. Or we can continue to go through those that appeared on any of the top 10 lists quickly to see what other ones the group might want to consider for their own
we could just try to get even get to the 10, just to see if we could get to the 10 quickly before we start taking the ones, taking things off and putting in the letter. And because I'm thinking like these are all very important, but they are rather than. I mean, we haven't, like, there's some big things that we have on this list, I thought we had on this list, that are much more systems reform things. So, can we just get there?
Yeah. All right. So we've been going off of the health disparities list, and I think we've got the top 10 there. So why don't we look at here's the top 10 on the overall list, and let's just see what we have. We'll go down from the top highest to the most highest from there. Talked about data collection, we talked about medication related to diabetes, emergency Medicaid, childbearing women, access to care.
Okay.
Mandated training on sexual orientation, gender and expression in the race program. 19
Actually, that's a different one.
That's
a different
Broadly. Oh,
19. Okay, let me just go.
Lot of disparity with that age group because they're transitioning out, but they have no.
Foster care is a
separate thing. Though that's a very good point. I mean, you know, this is a proposal that I had put forward that basically, as we know, that the age range of 16 to 24 are going to be a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of people are disconnected from services, whether because of a diagnosis. Reasons they're disconnected from services, they end up dropping out of school. We know that there is an incredibly high percentage of kids with
SED
diagnosis in school. That's like 45% drop out of school. So this was sort of developing the idea of some sort of comprehensive response by much more aggressively using Medicaid than she's right now to ensure that there's some sort of point of intervention for that population of kids, so both transition and youth, whether employment opportunity, vocational skill training, some sort of education, some sort of links with, community colleges, whatever links they need to get their GED or whatever they need to move forward. So there's much more aggressive use of Medicaid than we currently
that population.
I don't know if it's relevant, Glenn. I do know that there's another committee meeting today, a subcommittee for health homes focused on children and that has not been thoroughly controlled through the health home. So I don't know if that is a connection here. There was good care coordination for youth, and maybe we would be able to address that.
And Jess and I had some preliminary conversations around foster care, and one other package, and, you know, Greg Allen and his shop will be doing something in the future on foster care.
So
that's another potential disposition of some of these proposals. Some of the MRT committees are lagging behind this committee, have another month or two to come up with their recommendations for January, and the benefits package committee is one of those committees that is just at the beginning of this process. So if we thought something here was important, but we didn't want to make it one of our top 10, we would send it to the benefit, and if related to benefits, we could send it to the benefits committee.
I think it's the last MRT meeting is December 13th, so that's the one.
They've got basically another month.
I think on this, it may be conducive to a letter from this department, because as I understand it, this is a very complex issue, you know, foster care in general. And Greg and his shop have indicated that they're going to be starting to work on it. But it's going to take more time than between now and November 15th.
Diagnosis who are basically falling through the cracks in most of our population now that are living in the homeless population, the justice population. That this group is clearly a major disparity to the extent that we can address that in some way.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one on this list is one we didn't discuss yet, Cherry Care in New York State. So this one is the seven
and eight.
Seven SR and eight SR combined.
Exactly the accountability issues that we were talking about.
The thing with this is that the payment reform committee, we had this discussion.
Yeah.
The group can put it on. Our challenge going back is if we're really going to develop this into a full proposal, we're going to have to go to the same people that are providing data from the other committee. So I don't know what.
Not a problem.
Not a problem.
Glenn and I are there. Then they're going to go to the top five.
10 slots taken up by something that may be addressed more comprehensively, or certainly the MRT is looking to the other subcommittee on this issue. So I'm just putting it out there.
I do want to speak to that. And I didn't pick up because the LGBT and OMH and OASIS was the other one, and we haven't discussed that. But I thought that one of the things that we were using as a guiding principle for this was, for this process today, was that if another work group was carrying that our communicating to the work group, our opinion on that would suffice, as opposed to our putting it on our own list. If you're saying we want the same 10 things to show up in 10 work groups, then, you know, that completely different reorders the.
I would say that I don't think, I know that I'm not saying we want 10 same things to occur on another work group, but I am saying that there's something that is so central to there being greater accountability for a huge sum of money, that if that was on one or two more work groups, that would be absolutely fine, because it would highlight the essentiality of that being addressed. And I also think that the issue as to the dollars going to providers that are, and those providers being held accountable to to serve a very large population that experiences disparities in access and in health is central to this group.
Mm-hmm. In general, you know, these may be, again, the low-hanging fruit issue. This is really, you know, kind of one of the core issues. So, I mean, if anything, this is, and it is a bit of a heavy lift in many ways. And I think that it sends a strong message symbolically that captures a lot of the kind of things that we're saying around accountability of dollars and really communities that are most vulnerable really getting their fair share of dollars rather than those dollars just continuing to be issued in their name, right? This really, I think, sends that as a really strong message.
I just want to make a comment about the proposal. They don't address the non-hospital indigent care pool at all. And that's a huge concern for primary care providers who are serving insured patients. So that's a big missing piece.
It's not missing. I thought there in the body of the narrative of what was submitted, there was language about the DNTCs and the DNTC indigent care pool as well. And so my thinking, which is why I said providers, you didn't hear me say hospital, was that in the same way that we locked some data things together, we are saying we want to maybe broaden the pre-diabetes, that we might, as a group, make sure that we've captured all providers, or we refine or revise the initial proposal. In our 10, having a recommendation that relates to assuring dollars supporting the providers who serve some of the populations who have the greatest challenges in terms of access and disparities, I think we would be bereft of our responsibility if we did not do that. And I agree with you that it should not just be hospitals.
So just another comment on that. If you look at the payment reform, that's developing. Well, actually, they've already made a set of sort of recommended or draft recommendations.
Yeah.
They have one on this issue already, and it also leaves out the primary care pool. So if you're concerned about what's happening at the community level, that's not in a hospital. A huge oversight, even though it's only $50 or $60 million.
No, you are absolutely right.
Millions of dollars.
To your point, exactly, Elizabeth, my understanding is that my sense is the payment reform group is not going to go beyond hospitals, but we have the power in this committee to go beyond hospitals to make an argument for why it should be included here in addition to the payment reform.
And it does include providers.
I thought you said it did.
I thought it did, Elizabeth, so
we could amend it.
The non-hospital provider. And it talks about the DNTC indigent care pool getting 30 cents on a dollar.
It does?
Or we could just
whatever. It talks about it doesn't get it's not dollars aren't falling.
Okay, I think it's important for the that's putting on my work group member hat and taking off my chair.
And it's as is your right.
Just to be clear on keeping on our list here, the prior discussion around comprehensive psychiatric services to youth, is that one that we want to keep on the
That was the OASIS OMH training.
So is there a sense from the group that we want to keep those on our running top 10 list, the LGBT training and OASIS, OMH, and others? Is that one? Is that up here?
Cool. Yeah. I have a question on that one. I'm Charles. Is that something that you would be letter to this department to match, or is that you would want?
Well, this is see now we get into the politics of the of this group and what we're discussing here. That's why I had proposed the other process go first. Obviously, this one does not require statute budget or
The training?
You're talking about the training?
Which one are you talking about, Charles?
The training.
LGBT training.
It does require, what does it require?
Training. You're talking about training?
Yes.
So those are dollars.
Not state dollars.
Yeah.
Not Medicaid.
Okay, who's going to pay for it? I'm not opposed to it. I'm just saying, who's going to pay for it?
Could it be a non-funded mandate.
Yes, it would be an unfunded mandate, and I'm sorry, I have a lot of unfunded mandates, including mandated training that I have to do, and it could be a regulatory issue. That's where it sits. OASIS has the regs, and it says these following trainings must be done annually. OMH has the same thing.
Could be part of KSAC curriculum.
No, this is very specifically, this proposal is very specifically that there be a required annual training, which in regulation, you will see the OASIS regs have, these are the required annual trainings for OASIS, these are the required annual trainings for OMH, et cetera.
So just a comment, transmit that in a letter to the health department, so it sounds like the really mother state agency.
Exactly.
Just for clarification, when you're talking about the training hours in mental health, are you talking about the clinics? Are you talking about other outpatient programs? Are you talking about state operated? Are you talking
about the
yes.
It was very
proposal that clinical and other providers in all, basically all.
So what did we conclude? Did we include?
Well, I'm just trying to keep a list.
We're not making a final decision. This is just that.
Just making sure it stays on the list.
But yes.
And then we'll decide what to do with it.
Once we get our transition.
No, I'm not on it.
Okay.
And then 10 would be the charity
care. We're done. Time for lunch.
I'm deeply concerned that the mayonnaise is going to spoil on those sandwiches.
Health issue, don't worry.
I just want to say that for a second. So this is the same issue that I brought up before about diabetes. And it might be naive, so please correct me. The LGBT training seems to be one aspect of cultural competency in a broad, diverse perspective. And I know that that is a highly underserved and unknown dynamic for a lot of providers across all disciplines. But so are others. So how do we highlight this in absence of others? To me, it's about, if we're talking about health disparities, we're talking about greater competence of it's about, for me, it's more about enlightened thinking about who we're treating. The data provides the information about who we're treating, which is what we're lacking. We lump people together. This highlights one population that's deserving, more deserving than another population. That
I'm not. I wouldn't say that. I would say that was the one that had a proposal draft for it.
So if
there were other communities or populations that had cultural competence supports that were to the level of our clinician, then maybe put up a proposal.
So I just to respond to that, I think if we wanted to incorporate disability education in this as a bucket, I would certainly support that. I think the real issue here is there is data that looks at correlation between both addiction and mental illness and sexual orientation, and data around success in treatment dependent on whether or not sexual orientation and gender identity is recognized and dealt with appropriately in that setting. And this is very much in the front of my mind because we're filing a lawsuit against one of the largest drug treatment providers in New York State over a transgender woman who dropped out of treatment and went and did 2 years of jail. She was in inpatient treatment as an alternative to incarceration, and she chose to leave treatment and go to jail because of the way her gender identity was treated in the residential drug treatment setting. And so, you know, there is a real impact on this.
I'm not disagreeing that there's profound impact, definitely. I'm with you on that.
But I think the point is that it's systemic. It's a systemic issue.
Yes, bigger issue.
Okay, we're gonna break for lunch and come back at 1:30. And
yeah.
Oh,
I think we were
going to
try to make a call.
Oh, weren't y'all going to do all of this analysis over the lunch hour for us?
Folks on the phone, you're on here that we're breaking for lunch. We come back until 1:30. Yes.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.